Peter Bergeon knows a thing or two about microservices development. In fact, he knows a thing or two about microservices development with Go, as he is the author of the very popular Go Kit. Now, in a world where Java and peripheral JVM languages like Kotlin and Clojure and Scala are becoming increasingly popular, we were wondering about this trend towards native languages like your C++s and your Go. And so we asked Peter, why is it that these native languages like Go are becoming so popular?
It's a good question, and in my opinion, it's kind of been simmering in the background of a lot of developers' minds for quite a long time. I did JVM for a little while too. I'm really more of a C++ guy. But I remember when I was working on it, there was always this kind of reticence. Like, we all loved the maturity and the evolution and the iteration that went into the JVM and, you know, the garbage collector and all of the advanced stuff that's been happening there. But I feel like there's been a feeling of a desire to return to basics. And you see it crop up sometimes in different ways. Like, the latest, the big round of web startups in like 2006, they all built most of their products in Ruby, right? And Ruby's big sell was that it was so simple and convention-oriented as compared to Java. And so this feeling, this desire to get back to some sense of simplicity, I think, is ultimately what's fueled the native language trend. And so we have now Go, we have Rust, we have Swift. Am I forgetting another one? I'm sure there's a couple more. Maybe you could argue that Elixir, which is built on Erlang, is kind of that, but maybe not.
Now, you mentioned the simplicity of languages like Go, but doesn't simplicity sometimes lead to very complicated solutions?
Yeah, so there's a bit of this. And definitely, if Go has downsides, among them are the sort of verbosity of it and the lack of parameterized types require that you spell a lot of things out very explicitly when in other languages you might not have to. But I think what we're seeing, and in Go this is definitely true, I think also in Rust, we see that language features from the past, when kind of dusted off and brought into the modern context, can alleviate a lot of the pains that we normally associate with languages like C. So Go's big contributions in this realm were this native concurrency story and arguably like the implicit interface stuff. And with these two small features, I think you get a lot of value, or you get a lot of expressiveness that simply wasn't available in languages like C, and I think you really see a lot of benefits from that.
Now, we all know that Go is well-suited to server-side microservices development, but how well-suited is it to doing development with IoT devices, edge devices, smartphones?
Go is a general-purpose language, and so the ultimate answer to your question is it's ending up in all of these places. Historically, it started behind the server, behind the firewall, and this is how how Google has designed the language to solve their problems, and basically what they write is network servers, so that kind of makes sense. But even from the early days, Go was targeted embedded platforms, and I remember, I think a year or two after it was released, PayPal had this little device that you would plug into the wall, and it would act as like a point-of-sale terminal that you would use in a small shop. And the firmware for that thing, the firmware they would flash on the device, was ultimately written in Go, and they put a Go runtime on it. And so even from the beginning, it's been an IoT candidate language, and I think as the Go team at Google is exploring putting it onto iOS devices and Android devices more and more, it's kind of growing in that direction.
Now, there was a time not too long ago where nobody really wanted to be a SOA developer. SOA was not interesting. SOA was not cool. Yet, all of a sudden, there's been this giant sea change where the coolest thing that you can be doing is microservice development and working and deploying to Docker containers. And that's where people want to be developing today. So what triggered this shift?
I think you're right that there was something that shifted. SOA was the thing in the mid-2000s, and microservices really was only a term starting in, I guess, around 2011, 2012. And from my perspective, what happened was SOA got definitely reinvented, But it wasn't just a sort of an updating of names and that was it. What we learned from SOA was like things that worked and things that didn't. For example, WSDL or what's that other thing? Web objects? No, what am I trying to remember? In any case, there was a lot of stuff in SOA that like didn't pan out in practice. And what the microservice people kind of realized was that there's value here, and what we just need to do is kind of reimagine it, strip it down a little bit. And it was driven, in my opinion, by a couple of really high-profile success stories. And I think the original one, even though they didn't call it microservices, was Amazon. When Amazon shifted their kind of like software infrastructure to be completely service-driven or like service contract-driven or API-driven, however you want to call it, this sort of got some people's attention. And then the biggest companies, as far as I'm aware, that came after that that did call it microservices were companies like Netflix, who had great success with the model, and the company that I was working at the time, which was SoundCloud. I think we were one of the original ones, too, who started talking about it on the conference circuits. And so it's a combination of like updating the old patterns, taking what worked, refreshing what didn't, and then having like honest, real business success stories with this architecture that enabled what did they all say now, like extreme product velocity and all these lovely things that all the managers are looking for. So success stories, I think, is what fueled it.
The other big trend that we're seeing these days is this push towards APIs. Organizations are having API evangelists. People are talking about API architecture and API design. Why is the public API so important to enterprise organizations today?
The short story is like the web is being driven, and like modern technologies are being driven by developers. And if the way success looks in a lot of these industries and in a lot of these companies is when your product gets embraced and kind of extended by a community of often amateur developers. And the way we do that now on the web is with APIs. And I think SoundCloud is almost a perfect story for this. Like SoundCloud by itself, it's pretty clear. You like upload your tracks and you send links to your friends and they can listen to them, and that's all fine. But SoundCloud from the early days had a very developer-focused back-end site, an API site. So you could build sort of hacks, like hackathon-type enhancements, where you could build playlists in certain ways, or you could embed the player widget in your own site and embrace and extend the kind of content that we were delivering. And SoundCloud got a whole lot of really great organic, engaged growth through that channel. And I think that has been part of the success story for a lot of tech-focused, consumer-oriented companies for the last several years.
And certainly the big trend in the world of microservices is the deployment of microservices to containers like Docker. What is this symbiosis between microservices and containers?
Definitely. Docker was like the meteoric rise of the century, practically, going from a proof of concept to common knowledge in the matter of a year and a half, basically. So Docker and microservices are largely, containers and microservices are largely orthogonal, I think, but they complement each other very well. And if you go to the homepage of the CNCF, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, where I think a lot of this conversation is being driven right now, you'll see that it advocates this idea of what is the modern cloud-native architecture. It is microservice-oriented and container-packaged. So microservices and containers, like, you can do one without the other, but they taste really great together.
As someone who is working in the world of containers and container management and orchestration and all of those related technologies that make containers work, how do you feel about the maturity of those technologies and the maturity of the software container space?
It's tricky, and this actually speaks to a broader conversation about the whole market, not just containers, but containers and orchestrators and service discovery systems and load bound, like the whole infrastructure or operations developer kind of market is, I think, bit by bit becoming commoditized. And so we started seeing the container as a commodity, I think, a year or two ago. Very quickly, it became something that was kind of taken for granted, and then people started like with APIs, kind of embracing and extending it. And so now Docker is paying a lot of attention to their Docker data center, their swarm mode, this sort of like higher order abstractions on top of the raw container engine. And you see a lot of competition in that space too. I think the big three at the moment are the Docker Cloud or Swarm, Kubernetes, and DCOS from Mesosphere. I mean, they're all doing broadly similar things, and the kind of like relationships between them and between the container runtime and the orchestration runtime, they're all like, if you draw them on a sheet of paper, the lines kind of crisscross all over the place. It's really not clear what the like ownership or like peer relationships are there. And this is all going to settle in time, but at the moment it's very confused, I would say. And that's where all the energy is going.
Now, as enterprise organizations try and move away from their monolithic SOA architecture to a world of microservices, what type of advice do you give to them as they engage in that type of migration?
The number one thing that we've seen borne out by evidence and practice in the last several years is that you're never going to actually get rid of your monolith altogether. The process is always, it's this continuous process, and the monolith shrinks, but it never totally goes away. So the mistake I've seen most often is people who or organizations that dive headfirst and say, we're going to be fully microservice in 6 months or a year, and they start taking a hammer to their monolith, and they kind of like do too much too quickly. The process that seems to be the most successful, in my experience, is to take things very methodically and say, bit by bit, what is the one thing that we can separate and we can build in a good way separate from the monolith? Okay, we've done that. Now let's take a look at automation. Now let's take a look at monitoring. Let's build a good story around this one microservice. Okay, now let's do it again. And when we do it again, let's improve monitoring. Let's improve our logging pipeline. Let's improve how we do testing. And take it kind of methodically and with the goal in mind at the end of shrinking rather than kind of destroying the monolith. And that is great if you're sort of convinced that you need to do that work and if you're big enough to need to do that work. The other huge thing I see people doing that's kind of counterproductive is jumping into the microservice architecture before they need to. I think that microservices, and I say this whenever I tell people about whenever I give trainings or workshops, microservices are a solution for organizational problems. They solve problems of communication and product velocity and this sort of thing. They absolutely do not solve technical problems. They create technical problems, and a lot of them. And you have to be willing and able to solve the problems they create and be aware of them in order to successfully do a microservice thing. So another big problem I see, another big challenge is very small companies deciding they want to do microservices when, frankly, it's just premature and they'd be much better served by more typical monolithic or elegant monolith is a term I see sometimes, that kind of architecture.
So where can people go to find out more about what you're up to, about Weaveworks, and about GoKit?
Yeah, so I think Weaveworks, weave.works is the website for my company, and we're doing all sorts of developer tooling and productivity assisting stuff. So we have monitoring and visualization software, we have networking software, and we have change management and deployment software that we are constantly improving and directly targeting customers and enthusiasts in this space. And I'm also, in my spare time, the author of GoKit, which is the microservice framework in the Go language. And if anyone wants to learn more about that, they can go to gokit.io.